Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin. As regular listeners will know, this weekly podcast is devoted to highlighting social scientific studies of religion and religious institutions in an effort to get the word out to the general public about some of the interesting work being conducted in sociology, political science, history, economics, and several other fields. I also have a penchant for highlighting lesser-known scholars who often do not get the platform to discuss their research that the big-name scholars and pundits have access to. But in addition to this, I'm also committed to highlighting practitioners, people who live out their faith every day, but who may not have the opportunity to reflect upon it in scholarly journals. These folks, I argue, have as much knowledge about a topic, if not more, than many of us academics who have devoted our careers to the study of religion. Plus, it's really just interesting listening to the stories that all these people tell. And we've had everybody from Mormon missionaries to megachurch pastors and church security consultants to cowboy preachers. Today's episode will follow in that vein with my guest Michael Boone, the owner and founder of M.W. Boone & Associates, LLC. With over 30 years of experience as a wealth advisor, Michael is sought after as a nationally known expert in financial planning and investment management, and is possibly the most recognized financial advisor in Washington State, receiving such acclaim as being recognized as one of America's top 100 independent financial advisors by Worth Magazine. He has appeared on or been cited in such media outlets as CNN, The Wall Street Journal, Forbes, The Los Angeles Times, Consumer Reports, and The Hindustan Times, to name just a few. He is a graduate of the University of Puget Sound, where he played wide receiver on their football team, Go Loggers, and has attended executive seminars at Northwestern University, University of Pennsylvania, and the University of Chicago. We are recording this interview at his personal mountain retreat in Washington, a place he calls Living Waters. So any frogs that you may hear in the background are literally frogs. And if there are any screams in the background, that's probably me getting eaten by a cougar or a bear. So there you know. Mike, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thanks, Tony. Great to be here.
We have a really cool episode today because it might take us into a lot of territory that I haven't trod upon in the podcast yet, namely a spiritual journey on a motorcycle across the great Western United States. What a cool topic. But before we get into that, I have got to get a little background on you. Tell us about your religious background growing up and how you became a financial advisor.
Wow, yeah. I actually grew up primarily in Eastern Washington on a small dairy farm, a small family farm, and went to a small private school actually when even earlier than that, and kind of have known Christ since I was maybe 4 years old, and grown up in the faith, went to Christian school, and went to University of Puget Sound, played football there, and really wanted to get into work where I could serve people. I could use my talents and abilities to make a difference in the world. You know, the idealistic thing that everybody wants to do.
Okay, so 4 years old, you said you were with Christ, right? That's pretty young for a kid. I mean, 4 years old, I'm just kind of thinking of Tonka toys and stuff. So, I mean, does it date back that time? Did you have any, you know, periods in your life where you might be going, man, I'm not sure this whole church thing is all that good?
You know, I think that it's we all grow and we move closer and further away. But no, I pretty much have walked with Christ over that entire period of time.
Okay. Now, you made it into the world of financial consulting. And was that a long-term goal that you had when you went into college? Were you thinking, I'm going to be a financial planner? Or did that somehow happen fortuitously?
No. You know, I loved the idea of counseling people. So I was a business and psychology double major. And I loved the idea of counseling people. But, and this isn't very flattering, but I don't really like being around sick people very much.
Mm, yeah, well, yeah.
So I wanted to counsel healthy people. Mm-hmm. And that's actually not a job where you just, you know, throw out a resume for counseling healthy people. But it turned out that as I was getting ready for graduation and I was looking around for a job, investment advisor kind of stockbroker jobs were opening. And the markets were picking up in 1985. The bull market started in 1982. And so things were improving. And so there was places for salesmen. And I liked the idea that you could, you know, maybe advise people and help people who are in a pretty good position get into a better position. And then I just was very fortunate to be part of an era where there's a transition going on to financial advising, where you're actually helping people get to where their goals and dreams and desires are, and became a certified financial planner in the early 1990s and kind of launched forward from there.
Now, that's kind of an interesting thing that you're saying here, because you say, well, I want to counsel people. I want to help people, not sick people. And I hear you by that, too. I don't like going into hospitals or anything like that. So I'm there completely with you. But you want to help people out. You go into financial consulting. Now, this kind of blows away some of the stereotypes that we have of financial managers, right? They're bankers. They're just out for the bottom line profit. Whenever I go see my financial consultant, I automatically assume that they're interested in what their salary and commission are. So, I mean, it's kind of odd that you chose that path. I mean, here's the other question. Did your faith in any way work into your decision to do this or blend into it? Or were those two worlds kind of separate for you when you were starting?
No, that's a really interesting point, because they really were separate, but they shouldn't have been. So when I started off in the business, nobody said that you can be a person of high moral conviction, that faith can play a role in who you are, that this can be part of your purpose or your way of serving people. That was not at all part of any discussion that I had. And so I started off in the business basically thinking it was about a job, and it was a job that I could, you know, maybe do okay at. And I actually sucked at it. I was not good at it. And I got fired, and I got fired more than once, and was basically on my way out of the business after 3 years. And it turned out I couldn't get out of the business because all I had on my resume was failed financial advisor, which, believe it or not, there's not a lot of people putting up signs for, you know, failed financial advisor, apply here. So I thought, you know, if I'm going to do this thing, I'm going to have to get actually good at it. And I started to learn, you know, through difficult times and basically not eating well because of a low income, I started to learn that maybe what I really needed to do is to take a different approach than I had ever been taught before in the business. And that was to think first about serving other people. Like, what if I actually got good at helping people and made their lives better? Would that actually result in me doing better in my career? And it sounds crazy when you say it that way, because it should be that should be a resounding yes. That should be the way that everyone's told to build their career, is through good service. But nobody was telling me that. It was all about how many contacts can you make? How many hours are you spending? And so I flipped it on, and because I was self-employed because no one would hire me. So I started my own firm and suffered, you know, really low income, well less than $10,000 a year at one point. But I actually got good at it. I borrowed enough money to get my certified financial planner designation. And when I did that, I found out I could serve people. I could actually do a better job for them. And so I started thinking about this as, how do I make the world a better place instead of how do I get enough money to eat next month? Mm-hmm. And remarkably, my business started growing, and it started literally doubling. And then I thought, wow, this works so great. So I thought, I'm going to learn even more so I can serve even more, so I can give away more. And maybe if I serve and give people more value in their life, then it will actually work out pretty well for me too. But if I don't put that as the first goal is taking care of people. So I became a chartered financial analyst, which takes 3 years worth of study, and it's a really difficult course series, and my income doubled again. Remarkable how that worked. So after a few years of really just putting that as a primary focus of the business, we ended up Washington's fastest growing private companies list for 3 years in a row, which for a financial planning investment management company is crazy. I mean, that was all organic growth. So I'm just really thankful that I was able to stay around and fail long enough to figure out, you know, to find my own feet, my own values, and my own heart, my own spirit in the business.
Now, that's a really Smithian, as in Adam Smith, concept there. That, you know, I'm a big Adam Smith fan, and I know that he makes the basic argument that if you want to serve other people, if you want to serve your own self-interest, you have to serve other people, right? That the way you make yourself happy is to make other people happy.
Absolutely.
Right? So that's a Smithian concept, but is there anything during this period of time that things are pretty tough? You're making less than $10,000 a year, then things start turning around. Are you directly integrating your faith into this, or just you still just, you know, go to church on Sunday and it just kind of indirectly filters in? Is there any kind of direct connection there?
Oh, no. Yeah, it's absolutely driving me. I mean, you go to Matthew 25 and it's the parable of the talents. And what you have there is essentially the model for financial advising, or it should be the model for financial advising. It was central to what I was doing. First is the idea that you're giving and that you're getting, that you're supposed to be serving, that there's the idea of servant leadership, that you're humbling yourself and you're serving, and that's what your focus is on. But directly with regard to the parable of the talents, you have the master, you've got God giving talents and giving stewardship responsibility to different stewards, and very different outcomes coming about because of the level of stewardship that people are giving and the rewards that go to the stewards who really is a good steward. And I really took that to heart, that I would be that good steward, that I would advise people well, that I would lead them well, and that I would help them get to where they're trying to go. And that maybe by me working in this you know, with this sort of mindset, it would have an impact on the clients as well.
In terms of running the firm, were you pretty open about your spiritual faith in that with your clients, or was that just you don't need to like pray Jesus on their head or anything before you know consulting or anything? But
no, it's never been part of my marketing package. Mm-hmm. It's who I am. It's not an advertising slogan.
It just comes through daily actions.
Yeah. And if it doesn't, then there's no point in anything else anyway, right?
Good lessons out there for some of you who are listening, who are thinking about what your career path is. A lot of great advice there. I have to go now. We're gonna turn to your big journey, your 40-day journey here. So I have to do a full disclosure to our listeners here. You're not just some financial wizard that I pulled off the street to interview. You know, I didn't pick you off because I read Worth magazine and said, get this guy, he's in the top 100. No, we've been hanging out for a couple years now, drinking whiskey. We've been playing trivia, partaking in the reading of Adam Smith's Theory of Moral Sentiments. There's Smith again, and a bunch of other sundry activities. So I'm going to let you tell a story. How did we ever come to meet one another? Because my version might be a little bit hazy because I think it was in a bar. And tell our listeners a story about that one question you asked me at the Duval Tavern a couple years ago.
You know, maybe my memory is hazier than yours. You know, I think that we were went to the same church and knew some of the same people, and you seemed like a pretty funny guy. And, you know, a Christian who is willing to go into a bar and hang out with people is pretty cool in my way of thinking things. So I think that's how we got together.
But No, we started to say, hey, on Facebook too.
And yes, so,
that's what I see. Great things. You should visit our Facebook page at Research on Religion, Anthony Guild. A lot of great things come out of this. But yeah, you connected to me through there, and then we started hanging out and drinking together. But there was this one night that was really kind of interesting, right? The Duval Tavern. And you asked me a question. Remember what that was? You don't. Okay. See, so here's the question that you asked. I'm sitting there and you said, if you had the opportunity just for a month or so to do whatever you wanted to do, what would you do? And I turned to you without any hesitation. I said, I'm road tripping the West, dude. And you looked at me and you're like, no way, because that's exactly what I'm going to do. Right. And this was kind of interesting because I think around that time you were planning this amazing journey, weren't you?
Yeah. No, I totally remember now. Yep.
Okay. Yeah. Yep. So tell us about – so this was a couple years ago, probably about 2 years ago.
Yeah, maybe that we first met, and the journey was just over a little over a year ago.
Okay. So you advanced the idea to me probably a year and a half ago, and you're like, what are you going to do? And I said, let's do a road trip. And then you said, yeah, that's exactly what I'm doing, which is kind of, you know, like, oh, that's – and it surprised me because I'm like, you know, I will never do this thing. What are you talking about? And here you are planning it. So what is going through your mind? You have this in your head when you're talking to me about it. You're going to go road tripping.
Right.
What motivated you to do that?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think there's some roots. Growing up in the 60s and 70s, I think I read there were something like 50 Westerns on television in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and it dominated television. I think it was the way, the place that America was working out our values, deciding who we were, and the Westerns were the backdrop for that, were the setting. And I think in the same way that space is today in movies. And so I had that really as a backdrop. And then I began to study and learn more about the critical nature of wilderness within scriptures and how important it was to the development of the people and the faith. And I started to think it would be really cool to spend a fair amount of time in the wilderness. But it was a really unusual circumstance that actually got me on the track of doing this journey. So you have the Western aspect of just jumping on a horse and going off into the West like a cowboy, and a motorcycle, of course, being the horse. And then you have the Christian aspect of Christ going into the wilderness for 40 days, and maybe we can talk more about that. But it was sort of a back burner. You know, I've been able to do – my wife and I have been able to do a lot of cool things and travel a lot, but – this was not on the top of my bucket list until one day I was at work and my heartbeat seemed to be going really fast. And so I was talking to a client, and being the kind of borderline workaholic guy I am, I actually continued with the entire telephone call with the client. I had to lay down on the floor because thought I was going to pass out, but I didn't let the client know. I just continued on and gave them some good information. Got off the phone, called my wife, said, something is really wrong. So I had one of my employees come in. Turned out I was in atrial fibrillation, which is a heartbeat of 160 to 180 beats a minute in my case. And so got into the emergency room, and they tried to get some medication to get me out of it. I'd never been in it before, never had any health problems. And it didn't work. So they said, we're going to have to hit you with paddles. It's going to, you know, we'll get you back in your sinus rhythm that way. It'll be shocking, but we're going to have to knock you out because it's extremely painful, and it's much better to take that kind of pain when you're unconscious. So we'll give the drugs a couple more minutes, and then we'll be back in here to knock you out. So I had a couple of minutes then to figure out what was really important in my life. And not many people have that opportunity where you actually have a couple of minutes, you know they're going to knock you out. They told me, they said, look, we have to disclose there's a chance something goes wrong during this. You know, your heart could stop instead of going back to the regular rhythm. It's great. We got a lot of doctors around. We'll keep hitting it and trying to get it to come back. You know, you couldn't be in a better place to have your heart stop.
That's not all that comforting.
But by the way, your heart might stop. Yeah. So I had these couple minutes to actually just get together with the Lord and decide where I was in life. And I was actually okay with that. I actually thought, you know, if this is it, it's been a really good ride. And it's been a great journey, and I'm really thankful for it. And actually, I'm ready for whatever happens next. But if now isn't my time, there's one thing I think I'd like to do. I want to jump on my motorcycle and go out into the wilderness alone and do 40 days. And that was, you know, maybe not even in my top 10 before that moment. And just that moment, it hit me. That was like the one unfinished business that I had. And so that's actually where it started.
Okay. Now, you've never told me about this before, the emergency room thing.
That's what's the deep version.
Yeah.
We're going deep tracks.
How long ago was that before you made the plan? Was that about 3 years ago?
No, believe it or not, and this is the sad part, it actually took me 5 years from that moment to actually make it happen. When you own your own business and you're the primary person and your name's on the door, it's kind of hard to leave sometimes.
Yeah.
So, but at the end, it took me 5 years, but I was actually able to finally get it done.
Was that still lingering in your mind, though? Was this something that said, Lord, if I get through this, I'm going on the motorcycle next week, and then you get through it, and then you're like, oh, yeah, but I got these five other things to do, and you forget about, and then you see, you know, Easy Rider on the late-night movie or something. Or was this constantly, you know, for the next 5 years, you're like, okay, when am I going to do this?
Yes.
I got to get this done.
No, it was the latter. It was like I did not forget.
Okay.
I knew that that's what I had said. I knew that that was what my priorities were. And, you know, I think when you have that moment of clarity, those are two really important things, to learn that I was okay with whatever happened next. You know, I mean, people live their whole life and never get to that moment where they're okay to be done. And I was so happy that I got to have that moment. And then the second part of that was that, okay, there's some sort of knowledge or information or clarity that I got at that moment that I didn't have at other moments. Don't let go of that. Mm-hmm. There's some truth. There's some meaning there. There's some purpose in that thought being there at that time. Don't let go of that.
Well, that's good for you. That's a good lesson again for everybody. A lot of good lessons here, because I've had that moment, but I've let it drift away. So I got to recapture it.
They'll be great, right?
And I want to. So the whole idea of venturing out and hitting the West, for me, it was just, you know, as you mentioned, the Westerns, right? Just go West, young man, and just see where the roads take you. That kind of mystical journey, I think, for me. But you had a plan with this, and you'd already mentioned it. It's 40 days. And it was not until a few weeks ago when you mentioned that I was on this trip for 40 days. We were talking about it again. I go, 40 days. Well, that number 40 sounds kind of important. Wait a minute. Didn't Jesus go in the wilderness for 40 days? And you're like, that's the whole point. And there's a lot more 40s in the Bible. So tell us about 40.
Yeah. Well, I began doing study about 40 because it started popping up in some of these wilderness journeys. You know, we see Moses go into the wilderness for 40 years. It actually isn't spoken about in the Old Testament. It's spoken about, I believe, in Acts in the New Testament, where it says that he was, I believe, with the Midianites in preparation, really, for leading the people. He was in the desert in preparation for leading the people, which I thought was interesting. And then you see Elijah, after his prophets of Baal, Elijah the Tishbite, takes off running in Beersheba, and he's fed by ravens in the brook there, and he continues running and goes down to Mount Horeb or Mount Sinai, and he listens for God and he hears God in a still small voice, and that was his 40-day journey, and he comes back and he's changed by it and finds Elisha, and then of course it shows up with Jesus, and Jesus goes into the wilderness for 40 days, and it says that he was called by the Spirit or led by the Spirit, basically pushed into the wilderness by the Spirit for 40 days and 40 nights. And his ministry, as we know it, didn't really start until he came back out of the wilderness. But it started immediately after that. I mean, like, bam, it was immediate. And so there was a transformation that took place in that wilderness. And so I felt like if I'm being called to go on this journey— at this point in my life, that's a journey of transformation, and it's going to be 40 days, and it's going to, I'm going to be open to whatever I hear. There's not an agenda from me. What if, because I'm a planning guy, mm-hmm. right? I'm professionally, I advise and plan, I lead. And so what if I don't lead? I mean, what if in my own life, what if I surrender control to something besides me for a change? And it's been a pretty good ride doing that. But I get a sense that it was time for me to let go of that and to surrender. So I actually had no reservations, a very, very loose plan of going south, turning east, going north, and coming west. That was it.
And wait a minute. By reservations, you mean you had no hotel reservations and or reservations about should I do this or not?
No. Yeah, exactly. Neither one. So okay, I had no reservations, no hotel reservations, nothing booked. I stayed with friends the first couple of days. But past that, there was nothing on an agenda. And I also had no question about how I would do or whether I would do it. But I also gave myself there was an interesting moment when I pulled out of my driveway, which I would have thought would have been a pretty big moment. I'm leaving on this 40-day journey and my wife is totally on board with it, and she's waving goodbye. But it was interesting because this planning guy who hates to lose and loves to win, when I left the driveway, I gave myself permission to fail. I said, hey, if I'm not having a good time, if I'm not making any progress in this transformation journey, and I don't like it, and I make it to the end of my block and turn around, I am totally okay with that. That's all right. If that's the way I'm supposed to, if that's the way it goes, I am happy to do that. And so it was never this feeling of I'm doing this 40-day thing. It's like, no, I'm just driving to the end of my road and then we'll see what happens.
Mm-hmm. And you got to the end of the road and you kept going.
Yeah, I kept going.
So you kept going. I got to ask about some of the other preparations for this because I come from a Boy Scout tradition. And it's always be prepared. You took food and emergency blankets and stuff with you, right? You're on your motorcycle.
Yeah.
Okay.
I have this idea that we are either generally good as people at either accumulating, building, saving, planning, and preparing, mm-hmm. or we're good at living in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And most people aren't good at both of them. Mm. So I did really well on all the planning stuff. So yeah, I've got money saved. I've got my cell phone. I know how to read maps. I'm good in the wilderness. I've been in the wilderness my whole life. I know how to ride a motorcycle since I was 8 years old. So all the things that you need to do in preparation were done. Now it was time for me to do the other side. And I think the fact is that most people can't do both. You have got people that are savers and builders and investors, and they cannot let go, mm-hmm. period. They just can't let go. They go to their grave wanting to control all the variables. And then you have other people who really don't want to control any of the variables. And so as a result, they don't ever have the money and the motorcycle and the time and the preparation and the skills and the abilities. It's pretty rare that we're able to bring those – that you can bring those together, but it was a struggle for me.
Yeah, no, I can hear you because I'm one of those planners and savers. You know, we got so much food and stuff stockpiled for zombie apocalypse, but living in the moment, that's kind of difficult. Although I've had my moments where I've been able to do that, and it is extremely liberating in terms of that. Now, one of the other things that you decided to do, and I thought this was the absolute fascinating part of the trip, or one of the component parts of the trip, because this is something that I relish too, is traveling incognito. Mm. Why did you want to do that, and what did that really entail?
I've learned something more about it actually since I came home. But before I left, I live in a world where people call me a lot professionally to try to get me to use their investment management services with my clients and so on. So people have to be nice to me and they want something from me. And some people really relish that. I mean, that's what they dream of being at some point, is that person where everybody comes to them and wants stuff from them. And I don't actually love that. But I definitely wanted to take a break from that, a sabbatical. I wanted a break from being that person that got credit or got advantage or got attention because of what had happened in the past or the position that I was in. I just wanted to be a guy, the person next to the person that I was sitting with, without an agenda, without a reason to be, either liked or hated, because financial people can be hated too.
Mm, yeah, no, in fact, 99% of them are.
Yeah. No, exactly. So I didn't want any preconceived notions. I just wanted to be with that person, whoever I was talking with in the moment.
Yeah. And one of the funniest stories that you tell about this journey was that you did then in some way set up a alter ego in terms of this. And tell us the story, because it's kind of funny how this plays out on the trip.
Well, I had decided that I was going to be a sheetrocker. And I was going to do that because it was a humble thing. It was something that could explain why I was able to move around. And it wouldn't be something that people would think that they would want to take anything from me, or they would give me any special attention or credit for being a sheetrocker. And so I thought this was going to work out great. It turns out I actually didn't end up telling anyone I was a sheetrocker, because I'm a really bad liar. And fortunately, it just never came up. But it did have a really cool moment. I connected with a couple of guys in Yellowstone towards the end of the trip and sat down with them. Just had a great moment. They're from South Carolina, and they were working in the area. And I had a moment where I had a choice to tell them what I did for a living, and I just decided, I'm just going to tell them what I do. I'm just going to be honest and direct. I said, what do you guys do? He said, we're sheetrockers.
Yeah, it's one of those moments like, had I told them that I was a sheep walker, they would have gone into the whole business and like, oh, my cover is blown. Yeah.
I'd have been toast.
Yeah.
Completely uncovered. Yeah, I don't, yeah, which side do you screw it on? You know,
yeah, exactly. So, and I, admittedly, you don't look like a sheet rocker, right? Okay. I have to say, so you don't necessarily look like a sheet rocker.
Yeah, it was a bad cover.
But it is kind of cool that, you know, you don't have to tell anybody. You don't have to be who you are in that day-to-day working world, and you can just let life happen to you.
Yeah.
I think in many ways, which I think did that have kind of a spiritual aspect to it, or was that just?
I think there is. I think that if we're going to be a humble person that just serves other people, that it needs to not be about us, and whatever it is that we carry through life. That can be good things, and we deserve things. We earned things, great things, but they can actually become a burden, and they can weigh us down. And I was reading the Odyssey, and I was thinking about Odysseus and the idea of Greek idea, I believe it's Kleos, of wanting a good name and a good reputation. And when the guys were out there kind of just doing their thing, things went really well for them. But once Odysseus gives his name and Poseidon starts to beat him up a little bit, he starts to come in and give him some grief because it becomes about him and about his honor. And I think when you go in without a name and without an agenda, you can serve people and really truly be selfless.
Mm-hmm. And that's something that you discover along the way on this thing too. And we're going to get to some of those stories. But there's a couple other themes that you have talked about in this journey with me. And I want to explore those a little bit before we get to some of the good stories here. One of the things is you talk about the two halves of life, the Christian pattern of life and death. How did that play out in this whole journey? What were you thinking about there?
Well, you know, the Christian pattern is not of this stepping up to spiritual perfection. In my view, it's the story of death and rebirth. And it's a story of losing and gaining, and there's a loss before the gain, again and again and again. That's the Christian pattern. Christ goes down before he is raised up. There's the suffering before the victory. And what I think can happen to us is that we can really get good at avoiding suffering. We can arrange our lives so that they're pretty safe, so that we've built pretty good walls and not much bad can happen to us. And as much as possible, anyway, we can avoid suffering. And I wonder if by just building a life of security and comfort that we don't give up way, way more than we understand. And I wonder if you think about the book Wild, and you think about Into the Wild, Chris McCandless, and these are people with really nothing to lose. They go into the wilderness. They go into the wild. They go alone into the wilderness because they have nothing to lose. And that's pretty sad, really, mm-hmm. that we're so trapped by all those things that we refuse to lose that we won't take that journey. Because you can have a transformative, incredible, powerful journey and really be changed by it. Or you can insulate yourself from it, which I think is what we can often do with our wealth and with our success in our careers.
Yeah, that's an interesting theme there. And so you're letting go a lot of this stuff. The other thing that, and this you kind of recently sprung on me, is something called the 70-degree life. I don't think you've talked about that before. So what do you mean about that in this journey?
You know, it occurred to me that in my own life, I set the temperature of the house, say, fairly close to 70 degrees. And I get up in the morning, and it's not too hot, it's not too cold, it's just right. And then I walk into my garage, and I get in my car, and I set the temperature at 70 degrees. And I drive to my office, and I get into my office, and the temperature is 70 degrees. And I do the same thing on the way back home. And so we can live that 70-degree life, like the old illustration about a frog in a pot. Doesn't really realize it's being boiled. If you put it in hot water, it jumps out. But if you just turn it up slowly, it will actually stay in there and be stewed. And I think that we can be controlled by that 70-degree life, that our comfort range can get so narrow that we won't ever experience life.
Mm-hmm. And you need to experience those freezing points and those boiling points.
which is really funny because you do need to experience those. You need to have that experience of life. You learn different things. You're changed because of that. You're made better, I think, because of the strain and that stress on you. But the funny thing about it was here I talked to my friends about this 70-degree life I was abandoning, and my entire trip I never saw 70 degrees. It was seriously 113 degrees or it was of snowing and hailing in Yosemite, for instance. It was just crazy.
Well, let's get into talking about the actual journey here. And you did send pictures on the Facebook as you were going through it when you had connections. And afterwards, there was a flurry of Facebook activity and pictures reflecting upon this. And there were those moments. I have to admit about the 70-degree life. I thought, oh, this is really cool. And then we had that picture when you're bundled in your rain jacket. And I think all your clothes got wet or something. It was like this horrible experience. I'm like, why is he doing this, right? I was in that 70-degree life, and I'm like, I don't know, 70 degrees sounds really good right now. He's in 30 degrees and pretty miserable. But it must have been an exhilarating experience. So go ahead and take us on this journey. Tell us where you went and how the journey progressed. You got past the end of the block.
I did, and then I kept rolling. I have a friend of mine in Yakima, about 3 hours away, and stopped and saw him the first night. Went to his church the next morning, which was a great experience. And I headed down to Bend, Oregon, where I stayed with another friend for a few days and went out on hikes and did a lot of hiking from there as a base camp. And then basically I headed straight south from there. I climbed Mount Lassen, which had been on my list for a long time. Had some good experiences there. Down through Tahoe, Yosemite, down through Death Valley, across Nevada, and then hit a ton of parks in Utah, Bryce, Zion, Canyonlands, and then into the Four Corners region, up through Colorado, Rocky Mountain National Park, into up by Yellowstone and Jackson Hole, and then Lolo Pass across to Lewiston, Idaho, Nez Perce country. And then the last day of the trip, I was not really sure exactly what I was going to do the second to last day. And a friend of mine had a heart attack or had a heart problem, and he was hanging on the edge of life or death. So I decided to drive 3 or 4 hours out of my way to just go spend some time with him in the hospital, and then finished up back home.
Yeah, a really interesting kind of finish to that, because that's what prompted you to begin with. Some big reflections there. So,
yeah. Wow, that's a great point. I actually hadn't thought of that till just now.
Yeah, I hadn't either. Cool. This is what's cool about these podcasts, right?
It was being open and being available to what the Spirit would lead at that time. Because normally in my workaday life, during the middle of a work week, I'm not going to drive to Spokane from here. You know, it's a 7 or 8 hour round trip. But I had the time and I had the space and I made it available, and it was great.
This is one of these coincidences that are just too coincidental that it's got to be providence. The Spirit working is that prompted you in the hospital when you were laying there with 2 minutes before they say they're coming in with the paddles, and then kind of finishing up with, you know, somebody else seeing them on the other side seeing that. So, interesting. So you do this, you're going out into the quote-unquote wilderness, but you're on a motorcycle. You're not actually trailblazing things. You're on the freeways and side roads of the Western United States, Northwestern United States. So you're going to run across people, right? And the spiritual journey is not just about you going into the wilderness, but it's about you encountering other individuals and being able to better understand yourself during this whole process. Tell us about some of the people that you met. And here's the really bigger meta question behind that. Did your view of humanity change throughout this trip?
Wow. Yeah, I think there's some trade-offs that I had to make when I put the trip together. The trade-off is, if you want to be in national parks, which is where I wanted to be, you have to have reservations well in advance. It's just the way it works. I mean, even for campsites. So I learned pretty quickly once I get about south of Lassen that if I wanted to stay in a national park, I was out of luck, because you need reservations. Very few campsites open. You have to be there first thing in the morning, And then it wasn't going to work for me. So I ended up staying in motels a lot. So the wilderness aspect of it, the deep wilderness, I had some moments, but it was definitely not as much as I would have originally thought or hoped for. But the trade-off was, again, I could just let the spirit blow me wherever I want. The flip side of that was, or the payoff, the benefit, the reward, the fruit of that was that I ended up being in a local pub every evening where I would sit down, because coming alone, it's best to sit at the bar where you at least are looking at, you know, a television or someone's back and not sitting awkwardly in a table alone. And so I had great conversations with people. Sometimes they were out on the trail, and I'll share one of those stories, but oftentimes it was the person sitting next to me at the bar stool, and it was their story. And by the time I came home, I completely felt a renewed sense of optimism about people. There are a lot of really great people, and they don't end up in the evening news. And so we can, if we let our worlds get small, except for media, then I call that a small world, because the actual connection with real people becomes pretty small. And I found that the wider that I made that net, the more people are good people, a lot of good people in America. So that was great. The actual highlight, I would have to say, would be those relationships and those conversations I had with people were often unexpectedly the highlight of the whole trip.
Well, let's get into these, but I have to stop a moment. I just had an epiphany, and I get a lot of these epiphanies throughout this entire podcast series. People say things that I had never expected, and all of a sudden my mind goes off with fireworks. And I had never thought about the actual physical setup of a bar, right? That if you're alone, you go to the bar. You don't sit at the table, because that seems really awkward. Nobody wants to engage with you. But it's those bars with the stools all sitting forward. And I always gravitate to those. That you sit there and it says, I'm alone, but I'm still open to everybody who's on the left of me, on the right of me, and the bartender who sometimes has their back to me, but when they're not busy, will talk to me.
Right.
It's a really interesting place on this earth, that bar stool.
And think about that, Tony, because what you're saying completely makes sense. But think about the fact that you're all shoulder to shoulder.
Yeah.
You're all looking in the same direction.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, the physical aspect of it really, you know, is very, very different than in a normal restaurant. It's a pretty cool place.
It is. And that's why I probably like that so much. I probably like it too much. I don't know. But so go ahead and tell us about some of the characters you met, some of the stories. You mentioned you had a trail story. I'm sure you've had some stories in bars. Give us some of the more memorable highlights and what that meant to you spiritually, too.
Well, I think first I want to contrast it with the kind of road trip stories that I was familiar with in advance. And then I do want to share a story with one of the trail stories with you. But you know, if you think about American road trip books, there would be the Charlie and Me, On the Road by Kerouac. And I was thinking particularly about On the Road. And to me, as I read that book, and I realize it's, you know, it's a famous book and a great book by a lot of people's standard, but I didn't like the book at all. I found him to be what I would call an adolescent, a very, very selfish person, taking his aunt's financing the journey. He's not paying his own way, and he's taking from whoever is along the way, you know, recklessly just taking for himself. And so here, this is contrast with my experience. So I'm out on the trail, and I'm at Lassen, and I've climbed Lassen Peak actually that day, and I still had a little bit of energy. I wanted to go get another hike in. And I got down to the end of the trail, and there's a beautiful waterfall. But it's towards the end of the day, it's getting towards sunset, and people are heading back out on the trail. And so there's only just me and one other person there, and it's a woman who's maybe about 50-ish, about my same age, who's there. And she wanted me to take a picture of her with her camera, which is an ordinary thing, except it was evident that English was not her primary language. And so But it was also evident that she was a little afraid to be giving me her camera, which is not normal. She's a little afraid, and she has her purse with her, which is a little unusual, and she keeps pulling it back by her feet. So she's really a little nervous, a little bit uncomfortable with this situation, but she definitely wants her picture by the waterfall. So I take the picture, try to make her comfortable and help her out and give her phone back. And then she starts kind of wandering around, and it's evident that she doesn't know exactly how to get back out of this place. And so I come alongside her, and I say, "Excuse me, can I help you?" And you can tell she's afraid, but she's also really in need. Normally, you could tell she wouldn't have had this conversation, but she's in need at this moment. And so she says, you can. I don't know how to get out of here. I don't know how to get back. Just kind of point me the right direction. And I said, "Well, it's no problem. I'm going back right now too. So let's go this way." So I started leading her up the trail, and she wouldn't walk with me. She walked well behind me, maybe 10 steps behind me. It was really kind of strange. She spoke Spanish, and turns out she was from Spain, from Barcelona. Her name was Maria. I said, I know a little bit of Spanish. Dos cerveza, por favor. She said, "If you say so." So it turns out we're walking up the trail, and by the end of the trail, 3, 4, 5 miles later, she's letting me help her up. I put my hand out and I help her up steps, and she's letting me help her through the difficult places and carry things for her so she can make it back. And by the time we make it back to the motorcycle, she is saying, "I need your email. I need to get a hold of you. I love America. My favorite place to travel." She said, "Americans are so friendly and they go out of your way. And I have a great experience here. And oh my gosh, you ride a motorcycle? I need a picture of that." And so she has a picture of me standing next to the motorcycle, probably has her own wonderful story of this experience. But it was just a great, for me, it was a great thing to be able to span that cultural differences, to be able to provide support and help to somebody who was very skeptical at the beginning, to show that Americans can be good people, but also to connect with somebody in that environment where somebody has need. I've had that experience. We've traveled internationally and people have bridged that. It's a really great moment. And I enjoyed that. But I contrast that with on the road to say, wow, what a different kind of way to travel the world, You know?
Actually, as you're talking about this, it goes back to your business philosophy, too, is just going out and helping people because, You know, there's be a lot of skepticism. There's going to be a lot of nervousness about who is this person trying to give me a financial advice? Are they really out for my best interest? But if you do go out and serve other people, a lot of really cool things come of it.
Absolutely.
And you need to let yourself do that, and you need to let that happen to you. I think it'd be interesting to trace down Maria and get her side of the story on this thing.
I've got her email.
But any other memorable stories? What do you have?
Oh, just a lot of, you know, more than I can share. But I had a cool solo moment, a few of them. One of them was I climbed Dana Peak in Yosemite. And this was the horrible weather, again, straying from the 70-degree life, and went out to climb a mountain, a 13,000-foot mountain, and there was nobody else on the mountain. Literally, the last guys came down and said, "Hey, there's nobody else up there. The forecast is really bad." And I went and had a really awesome experience anyway on a motorcycle and cold and dangerous. But again, getting outside of that normal, I'm just gonna go do it. I'm gonna be bold and so that was cool. I had some great times out on a place called Burr Trail in Utah, where I really did get off the main road and just do what's called dispersed camping, where I just throw my tent out in the middle of the wilderness and nobody knows where you are. You're off the grid. It's completely no reservations, and you just go. And the nights I had out there was fantastic.
Was there a sense of trepidation in doing that? Like, well, what if, you know, a flood comes through and nobody's around to help me or something like that? Describe that feeling.
For me, there really wasn't a lot of fear. Like I said, you know, that after that experience in the emergency room where I said, you know, I'm okay with dying. That's not the worst thing that can happen, really. And so once I was okay with that, then the adventure is just, you know, living in the moment and being free to go out and enjoying it. But I do believe that there is something when you let go of security and comfort, there is something on the other side, and I wanted to find out what it was.
So you went out and you searched for that. And now I want to kind of turn in the 10, 15 minutes we have left here or so, what you pulled out of this, right? So you went out searching for something. Did you find what you were looking for? Did you experience something that you did not think you would find, or you were surprised about finding? A year after this, what are your reflections?
To me, that it was meant to be a journey of transformation. And if things weren't different when I came back, then that would have been disappointing. But I didn't know how they were going to be different. And I didn't have an agenda or a focus on what was going to happen. I wanted to let the spirit lead. And if I woke up in the morning and wanted to turn left, that's what I was going to do. And so it was really, it was an amazing experience to let go of that planning and agenda and what I have always done, pushed on and driven on to the next thing, and let go of that and just said, hey, whatever the spirit, wherever it leads, I'm going to follow. It was very, very freeing to do that. And it was a little bit addicting too, because I came back home and I thought, you know, that's actually a better way to live. Somebody once said that we're supposed to walk by faith, not by sight. And I realized on my trip that I've been living by walking by my sight. I was living in the flesh, only with what I could do. And it was going well, but it wasn't going well enough. I knew that. I knew I needed to be transformed. And that transformation involved surrender. It started with surrender, just me flat, just giving up. God, I'm trying to grab hold of the wheel, and I need to be letting go of it. So you need to take over, because I'm going to let go. And that's what I did. And so when I came home, I realized that was the way I had to live. But I realized that in my role within my business and my firm and what was expected of me, I couldn't do that. I couldn't do that. I was in charge of driving the ship. I have to have my wheels, my hands on the wheels. And so something had to give. I either had to actually bring fruit forth from the trip and make it a difference in my life, or I had to pretend like that didn't happen. I had to ignore it. I have to say it was a good 40 days and I move on with life. And I wasn't prepared to do that. So I decided to let go. And so I basically had to restructure my entire business around that. And it took a year, and I worked hard and diligently, and it was not easy. Because what I found is that everything in life, everyone is happy when you're enslaved in a way, you know? Everyone is happy when you're making money and paying taxes, and that's great for everyone, except maybe, you know, maybe what you're calling and what your spirit is leading you to do. And so if you try to get off of that path, it's going to be way harder than you think. That's my takeaway from that. But a year later, I've restructured my business. I am my job title is now founder. I am not the guy driving the ship on a day-to-day basis at all.
Mm-hmm. Now, a couple of the themes that we wanted to talk about in terms of this reflection, I find rather interesting. We haven't had much time to talk about this in bars, but it's the issue, the importance of Sabbath, right, that you have brought up. And then also the ability of why, or not the ability, but the reason why many people don't take this opportunity for Sabbath. Now, not everybody's in a position to completely let it go, right? You have to, you know, a lot of people still have to, you know, show up at work every day to make sure that they can get their, you know, food on the table and kids through college and all that kind of stuff. What kind of lessons would you say are important for them that you might have learned in talking about Sabbath and,
right,
and that?
Well, maybe I'll answer the second part first, because that you're hitting close to home there for a financial advisor. I don't think most people need to live the kind of life that they're living. I think they choose to live that kind of life, and they choose it by getting into debt, by buying things that they don't really need, and then those things drive their life. So they say, oh, I've got this bill, this bill, this bill, and they bought those things. We choose. We make our choices. We make those choices. So when you talk about choice, issues of choice, what you're saying is that the cost of giving those things up is too high. And that makes complete sense. On one side, you've got this very intangible benefit of freedom, whatever that means, of the ability to follow the spirit, of being living without a huge weight over your head to change your way of thinking. But on the other side, you have all the things that normal people do. And normal people are in debt and tied down and shackled and And they're okay with that, I think, mostly because this is what people do. I think that's some of that's just is our era. So I don't think people need to do that. I don't think that they realize that there are other options. And I don't think that they value that freedom enough to pay the cost. So the idea of Sabbath, my wife and I have led a number of trips to Israel, and we've been, I think, lived there essentially 6 months of our life over the last 15 years or so, and absolutely love the country and the lessons that we've learned there. But one of the powerful lessons from Israel is the idea of the Sabbath or Shabbat. They really get Sabbath there. You can argue that they, you know, about whether it's overboard or not, but they really, they're Sabbath day elevators, and you don't even push a button. They only go up one floor. Some places, actually, the elevator only works on the Sabbath. It's actually resting the rest of the week so that the main elevators can rest on Sabbath. Even the machines are resting. Of course, the land is supposed to rest every seventh year, and we've kind of thrown that one out. I would say that remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy is probably the most happily broken of the commandments by most Christians, because we become important and busy, and we identify our importance with how often we break that. And everyone nods and says, oh, yeah, I understand why you don't get Sabbath. Of course, God gets Sabbath, but I actually don't need a Sabbath. And I think that that's it's horrible, and I think we're paying huge, huge cultural price for that. So I think that we don't take Sabbath. I think we're supposed to take Sabbath. And I think that rest is built into creation. It was written into from the very beginning. God took a break not because he was tired, needed a nap. He was showing us that even God gets Sabbath. And that's supposed to be who we're supposed to be following.
How does one do that in this modern era? I'm listening to you the past hour here. I want to hop on my motorcycle now, except I don't ride a motorcycle because I don't trust my balance. Maybe I should. I don't know. But I would get in my truck and take off, and that'd be cool. But, you know, it is hard to let go. How would – I mean, here's an interesting question to kind of contextualize this. You still deal with clients in your financial business. How do you advise them differently now, or do you?
I don't really think it's different. It's their dream and goal desire that I help lead them to. It's not mine. So I don't think that's really changed from that standpoint. But as far as whether, you know, how you deal with Sabbath, you know, I recommend that you plan a Sabbath. You actually do it. Realizing that you can do a lot of those things. You can get stuff done in 6 days. Also realizing that it's meant to be inconvenient. It's meant to be a full stop. It's meant to not fit into your agenda or your schedule. What God is saying there is, this is the way I made things, and it's meant to stop. That's why it's a commandment. It's supposed to stop. Everything is supposed to stop. And yes, your life is going to look different, because if it didn't, what would be the point, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it's going to be hard. And to me, I went as far as to buy a property to come out where I could Sabbath. And, you know, the ad where they're on the cell phone, you know, can you hear me now? Can you hear me now? When I got out of cell phone range, now I'm looking for a property. Mm-hmm. You know, people say, I want a cell phone. I want to be able to get to my cell phone. It's like, I don't want to be able to get to my cell phone. And that's why it's one of the things I love about this place.
Yeah. And so we are sitting here at the place that you call Living Waters. What's the purpose of the name? Why did you name it that?
One of my favorite places in Israel is a place called En Gedi. It's a waterfall tumbling down into the Dead Sea. And from the very first time I was there, it felt like home. It was actually strange. People, tourists started asking me for directions. And somehow I sort of knew where things were going to be. It was an interesting experience, but that place of cool refreshment in a parched desert spoke to me at a lot of levels. I knew I needed cool refreshment in a parched desert. And so I was looking then for an En Gedi, for a place. David was there in that area. People have lived there, you know, thousands and thousands of years. It's been a place of refreshment. You don't spend all of your time at En-Gedi. What you do is you get refreshed and you get strong, and then you go back out to the desert and you fight the battle that you're supposed to fight. You don't live under that waterfall. Tempting as it may be to just say, yeah, I want all of that refreshment for me. There are people in the desert. And so you get refreshed, and then you're able to go back out and refresh others.
So looking back at this journey, you've done the 40 days. Do you plan to do it again? Any plans to do it again?
I don't think I need to.
Okay.
At least not now. If I get the Spirit calls me to do it again, I'll do it. But
so having experienced this, the next question is, what next?
I have I'd like to write about this. I think that I've learned some things along the way, the journey, that might be entertaining, helpful, useful, enlightening. There might be some reason for other people to want to know about that journey. And so I feel a burden to share that. So that's the number one thing on my agenda right now.
I'll prompt you on that. Do you feel a burden to share that, or do you feel a joy to share that?
No, it's completely a joy. It's a joyful burden. But what I mean is that it's a claim on me. In other words, I think that we get to have wonderful experiences in life, and that's great, and that's fantastic. But I think there's also fruit that can come from those things that go beyond that experience, if you're willing to be open and to share that fruit, you know?
Well, it is an interesting claim to have on your time and your talents, and we look forward to seeing that book in print. But we thank you very much for sharing this journey along with us, and maybe other people will have similar journeys, be inspired by this. And if you do, please contact us. We'd love to hear about it. And I want to thank my guest, Michael Boone, for being on Research on Religion. Michael, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Thanks, Tony.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.